Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you.
The Tim Hill Podcasts, ordinary people's extraordinary stories.
Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. In this episode, I'm going to have a chat with Charles. Charles is going to tell us all about his life. So, Charles, you're in the room.
How you doing, Tim? Very good.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. So, Charles, if you can tell me when and where you were born, and if you can describe to me what it was like where you grew up, the schools you went to, and the education that you received.
Well, I was born in how everyone outside of Worcester calls it, Worcester, Massachusetts. They don't say it like we do. Yeah, they say it differently. Well,
Worcester.
Yeah, we say Worcester, but a lot of people say Worcester.
Worcester, yeah. But we had the same with the sauce.
yes, definitely.
Worcester sauce, and they call it Worcester sauce.
Right.
What are you on about?
I know it's weird, but I was born in 72, which makes me 50 years old now. And
congratulations.
Thank you, I think. And what it was like when I was growing up, let's see. I started going to school here in Worcester. I did kindergarten and I think first grade here. And then my father lost everything that he had, and when I was six, my mother passed away. And then shortly after that, my father moved us to all kinds of different places. I literally, I have a book published called 10 Homes in 11 Years that talks all about my first 11 years of life. And I lived in 10 different places in 11 years.
That's pretty tough growing for a kid.
Yeah, and some of them was Van Horn, Texas, on the border of Mexico. And the Navajo Reservation in Arizona.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, do you have Indian heritage then?
No, I don't. My father was a chef, and he was given a job to cook at the college on the reservation. Hmm. So we were given housing there, and I was allowed to go to school with the kids that were there, and that was an interesting time too.
Yeah, how long did that last for?
I think that lasted a couple of years. Me and my sister eventually came back here to Massachusetts when I was 11. Yeah, my father passed away when I was 11 years old.
That's pretty rough, losing your mum at 6 and your dad at 11.
Yeah.
So, who looked after you then?
Well, my aunt and uncle were my legal guardians, or my parental figures, and my grandfather and my grandmother were my legal guardians. They lived next door to us. Yeah, yeah.
So your father died. Was that why you were on the reservation?
That was in Van Horn, Texas, actually. He it's one of the only memories I have of back then was the day that he died. I don't know why. The mind is weird. We remember some things that we would probably rather forget. But I remember waking up that day and I looked at him. We were in a dirt poor apartment, and me and him shared a bed. Outside of the bedroom was a kitchen, and we had the coffee pot, and we had the refrigerator, and he was making coffee, and I just had like this really bad feeling come over me. And so I went up to him. I said, I want to stay home from school because I just had a really bad feeling something was going to happen today. I didn't want to go to school. He told me I had to go, so I went into the bathroom and I shoved my finger down my throat so I would throw up and tell him, you know, prove to him that I'm sick. You know, and he passed out a couple of times on me when we were during the day, once in a store and once at home. When we were at home, I went to get my neighbor after he passed out the second time, and then we got him to the hospital. And then we, me and my father were there. He was laying on a gurney, and I was there holding his hand, and he passed away. And then...
That's pretty tough on an 11-year-old. Where was your sister?
She was in school at the time.
So I guess, that brings in all sorts of problems. I mean, I guess you were the good person that broke the news to her.
Actually, the police, I guess, broke the news to her. I honestly don't know where I went after that. And I know that me and her ended up at her friend's house. And that's where we stayed until my grandfather sent my uncle down to come and get us in Texas from here in Massachusetts. Hmm. But I don't remember the transition. My sister told me that the police told her that, you know, do we have any family around here? And that sort of thing, you know, like the normal questions. And she just said that her best friend is the closest family that she has around here in Van Horn, Texas.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was really traumatized. My sister even told me that for the first 6 months of being back home, I was a mute. I didn't talk.
Hmm.
And I totally forgot about that until I was writing that book and she told me about that.
Yeah. So bereavement is a funny old thing, and the grieving process, it affects everybody differently.
Yes.
In fact, I've just done a live stream for a couple of weeks about bereavement and different people's different journeys and how they've coped and got through it. So.
Yep.
So, Becca, you got back to Massachusetts, and what happened? Did they put you straight into school, or did you have a couple of weeks out? How did that work out?
That's a good question. I'm assuming that we had a little bit of time out, but I'm pretty sure we went back to school as quickly as we could because I had already lost a lot of school as it was, moving around as much as I did. Mm-hmm. You know, and I paid for that through my whole 12 years of academics. You know, I felt like I never really caught up, and I gave up after a while. Because I never caught up, you know, and I began hanging out with the less favorable crowd in high school, the potheads. And then I was stoned every day when I went to school. And throughout the whole academic day, you know. And then and that turned to other things, but
so I guess your schooling was pretty sporadic, to say the least. And so did you actually manage to graduate?
I did. Like I told my son, I graduated with Fs. But I graduated. Because I'm always on him about his schoolwork. Because, I mean, if you want it, you can do good. But I didn't want it. Like I just graduated college a couple of years ago at 48. You know, and I graduated top of my class. You know,
I guess that's because you wanted it then.
Yeah, because I wanted it.
And when you're in school, I mean, people say that the school years are the best years of their lives, but that's not everybody.
No, it's not.
I mean, my schooling was pretty lousy, to say the least. And, I was lucky to get where I did when I did. So I guess you're similar. So what happened at the end of high school then?
At the end of high school, during the last couple of years of high school, I started really drinking more and more. And getting into other drugs, crack cocaine, and smoking pot like it was going out of style. And after high school, I just sort of existed for a couple of years. I went to what they call postgraduate, and that's like 1 year after high school. I went in for mechanics, like an extra year of school, and but I just existed. I mean, I didn't learn much that I didn't already know, you know. And then it came to the point where my aunt told me, you know, get out, get a job, but don't come back, because I was in such a bad spot in my own head. You know, and which was tough love that I needed at the time. You know, so I went out and I joined the military. I told her I got a job and I'll be leaving in a month. You know.
So, how did you get in the military? I know the British military, when you're applying, one of the things they do is test you for drugs, and if you've been taking drugs, then do one. You can't join.
Yeah, they didn't test us right away. They tested us at what they call the MEP station, and that's where you take your IQ test and all that other stuff, and that's where they test you. And by that time, I had stayed away from it enough to pass the test.
Yeah. So you managed to get into the Army. What branch of the Army did you join?
Army Infantry, mechanized infantry. Yeah.
So working on what we call 4-3-2s is the, what's the American version of the?
I drove the Bradley fighting vehicle.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
because we back in my day it was American version of the AF3 432, which is armored personnel carrier.
Oh, okay.
I guess they moved on from that. Was it a 101 they called it in American?
We still had the 101 when I was in.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean that's why I had to go out driving once. Get a bit of that.
I drove those once. I drove that. I drove the Abram. I drove the. My main vehicle was a Bradley, though.
I thought Bradley was a tank.
It is.
All right. But it's armored infantry use it.
Yeah, it's a mix between a tank and a personnel carrier. You have the driver, the gunner, Commander. The PC, and then you have room for like five people in the back.
All right.
Yeah. You can carry a squad with you.
Yeah, half section, we call it.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And you sort of drive into battle.
Yep.
So where did you do your training? Where's the infantry training depot?
Fort Benning, Georgia.
Fort Benning.
Yeah.
That's hot and sticky, isn't it?
Yeah, it's down south near Florida. Yeah, it's really hot.
Yeah. Is that the only place that they train up the infantry?
As far as I know, yes. Yep.
Hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, so we used to, when I joined the army as an infantry soldier, we had different depots. So I went to the depot of the Queen's Division. There was the King's Division, there was the Prince of Wales Division, there was the Scottish Division, there was the Light Infantry Division. So they all had their own training depots. Now it's all done under one training depot up in Catterick in the north of England. And all infantry regiments go through it. But we're set up slightly different. We have regiments where you just, I think they're numbers that they, for infantry units. It's just the infantry. You don't have, like, I was a Royal Anglian. So we have Royal Anglian Regiment. And we have several battalions. Then you've got the Queen's Regiment. We've got the Princess of Wales Royal Regiment. We've got Royal Regiment of Fusiliers, which is all Queen's Division. Then you've got the Highland or the Scottish Division, which is split up into the Highlanders, the Argyll and Southern Highlanders. So lots of different regiments. But as far as I'm aware, the Americans just have sort of numbers. Sort of the 5th Infantry Battalion or something like that, is it?
Yeah.
10th Ranger Regiment.
Yeah, the 4th Infantry. I was in 4th Infantry.
So how long was your training for?
I believe it was 4 months. Altogether, I had the training and then the advanced infantry training.
Because so you had the driving.
Yeah.
So do they do the similar to we have sort of the first 6 weeks is square bashing, where they knock you down and they rebuild you. And then you go on to the more infantry skills and stuff like that. And then you go on to your trade training, as it were. So mechanized infantry, that's when you go off and do the specialist once you've passed out of basic training.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I remember a lot of the training. It was weird because we there was a time where the drill sergeants were allowed to strike the people coming in.
I don't think they was actually ever allowed to strike them. They turned a blind eye. I mean, there was two methods of punishment when I was in. Certainly in the early days, you could either get a sergeant's punishment, which is taking you around the back and give you one of them, or where you go on orders in front of the officer and they take money off you. So generally you took one of them rather than have money taken off you.
Definitely. I'll take a punch. But we were right where they got a lot stricter with that. you know, not allowing them to strike a recruit. And it even got to the point where they didn't want us to go into hand-to-hand training. Like, I remember...
When you got already in for training.
Yeah. Like, we were looking at the whole schedule like, oh, I can't wait to get into the hand-to-hand combat training. And then that came up, and a couple of days before, I remember my drill sergeant coming in fuming. And he said, you guys aren't doing the hand-to-hand. We're like, why aren't we doing the hand-to-hand? They don't want you to get hurt. What do you mean they don't want you to get – what do you mean? Like half of us are going into the – half of us are going into Afghanistan or Iraq after we leave here, and you don't want us to get hurt. Really?
That's good preparation, that.
Yeah.
You could make that sort of thing up.
I know. I mean, I'm a writer, so I probably could, but I'm not.
So.
Yeah, follow that one.
Yeah, don't want you to go. Love it. So when you finally passed out of training then, you've gone on to your specialist training.
Yeah.
What was your first draft? What was your first posting?
Fort Carson, Colorado.
That's different from Fort Benning in Georgia.
Yeah. I loved Colorado. Colorado was one of the most beautiful states that we have. It's got, like, just the majestic mountains and everything. It's just an unbelievable place.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, guys. It's Joel from Momentous Experience here. How are you going? If you listen to people that I catch up with here and around the world talking about their mental health, the challenges they face, and how they've managed it. It's all about spreading awareness and promoting a peaceful and balanced life. So join me again, Momentous Experience, on Spotify, Apple, and Google.
Now, forgive me, but mountains, armoured, don't really go together. Or are you on sort of a bit lower down on the plains?
Well, when we were training, we were lower down in the plains. But we also, when we were marching and stuff like that, we did the mountains.
Hmm.
Yeah. And some of us, not all of us, were mechanized. Like, out of 20, 30 people, maybe 10 of them were mechanized. The rest of them were Bravo, which is a foot soldier. You know, so they were still training in the traditional infantry way.
Hmm. So you had your APCs, your armored personnel carriers and all that in there, but most of it was sort of normal, what we call infantry skills, which is,
right,
for, you know, PBIs, we call them, poor bloody infantry.
Yes.
So do a lot, like, of foot slogging. and occasionally, if you're lucky, you get a jump in the back of a truck that takes a strain off your poor old feet.
Right, yep. I was actually my XO's driver. I was my XO's and I was my CO's at different times. Hmm. But they didn't go out on every mission, every training mission. So there was a lot of times where I got attached to one of the foot soldiers' squads. So, yeah, I did a lot of the footwork too.
Hmm. So how long was you there for? And was that the 4th Infantry Battalion then?
Yeah, the 4th Infantry Division. I was there for my whole time, 93 to 96. While I was there, I went to Cuba for 6 months, where we guarded Cuban and Haitian camps. They were trying to get over to the U.S., and we couldn't allow them to just walk on to our shores. So we put them into these camps to transition them into wherever they were going to go next. It was above me. I didn't know where they were going to go. But I also went to the border of Mexico. So that was like returning after all those years in a way. Yeah, it was actually near Van Horn too, where we went. But we were guarding the border of Mexico against anybody coming over from Mexico illegally.
Yeah, I thought that was the role of the border police.
It is, in 95, I think they, or maybe it's something that they always do, but in 95, we were there helping them out. Yeah. I don't know if they always have the infantry there, but at that point, we were helping them out with that.
So how long were you in the 4th Infantry Division then?
3 years. I was in for 93 to 96.
And what happened in 96? Did you get posted somewhere else to a different division or?
I ETS'd, which was, I got out on an honorable discharge.
All right, so you served your time, basically.
Yes, yep.
Where did you go after you left the military?
Back home to Massachusetts, to Worcester, Massachusetts. And I worked odd jobs for a little while. And then I fell into a really dark depression a couple years after I was out of the military. What happened was my grandfather, who was my legal guardian, and my uncle, who was my father figure, passed away a month apart due to cancer. And that was like losing my father all over again.
Yeah, that's pretty, just that aside, that's got to give you some worries whether you're going to go down the same route, because I guess that's in the family then.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So were you entitled to use the VA?
Well, at that time, I didn't even know about the VA at that time. My depression got so bad, though, that I tried taking my own life. I took a bottle of sleeping pills one night and went to sleep. And my friends found me and found the bottle, and I was cutting on myself just to feel something other than what I was feeling, I guess. And I carved the words "F you world" into my arm. And they found me and they called an ambulance and I got rushed to the local hospital. And then the local hospital sent me to the VA. And that's where I found the VA. And then after that, I was homeless for a little while. And I I ended up being in veteran shelters and VA shelters for about 5 years. But I call that time my crucible because it woke me up. Because a lot of times I felt like I, like the world owed me throughout life, you know, for the loss of my mother and my father and everything that I went through. And then I seen a bunch of other veterans suffering and going through hell, just like I was, you know, and that really woke me up, you know, like I'm not the only one suffering here. I need to get off my butt and, you know, help some of these people out too, because, you know, we all need help. You know, and then I found out that I had PTSD, and I've had it since I was 6 years old, and that was huge.
You're losing your mother, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yep. And that was actually huge for me because, like I tell people now in the work that I do, I tell people that if you know what's going on with you, then you can combat it. You know, you can begin to heal and fix yourself. Mm. You know, because that's how I did it. You know, I didn't know what was going on with me all those years until I found out, hey, I have something called PTSD. And now that I know that, I've written books on the subject. You know, I've learned that much about it.
I mean, it's really, people get the wrong or don't understand PTSD. Yes. A lot of people think that it's just military that are affected when they're in combat and stuff like that, but it's not. It can be any traumatic incident that has an effect on the individual.
Exactly.
It could be somebody witnessing a road traffic accident, and years later, that develops into post-traumatic stress. The British military have started to use a thing called TRIM. So, but particularly if you're in combat, you get a traumatic incident. Sort of 72 hours after the incident, a team comes in, they assess everybody, put them into different categories, work out who needs individual or a group or just a general briefing, and then 3 or 4 weeks later they come back to see how people are doing, and if any time somebody's struggling with it, then they'll signpost them on to specialist treatment, and then they'll come back in again at the 3 month point, and if people are okay, then they'll just get on with it. If they're still struggling, then they'll get additional help. So that's the way that we've been dealing with it in the British military. But that's also been rolling out now across the emergency services, hospitals, anybody that is in an environment where they may come into contact with a traumatic incident, and trying to educate people for it.
That's mind-blowing. Because I wish that we had that in our military. Because as far as I know, we don't.
Mm.
You know,
and you guys, I've worked with Americans in the past when I've done a dozen operational tours. I mean, I did 3 tours of Afghanistan. I did a tour of Iraq. I did Kosovo. I did Macedonia. I did Northern Ireland. And then in the earlier days, where I mean, you could possibly term Germany and during the Cold War as operational tours. I mean, we were in Berlin, and we were literally, I mean, we were cannon fodder within sort of 12 hours, they would have wiped us out. But whether that's a reality or not is something else, but still kind of an operational tour. But although we're having great fun. Yeah, Berlin was awesome, trust me. Mm. Yeah, so this has been developed over the several years. I mean, the Royal Marines were doing it a long time ago. British Army have been doing it for the last 20 years now. And it's all part of your normal everyday training. There's also other courses, suicide awareness courses that we do, care for the carers type course, looking after yourself, basically, and identifying in yourself and in others that are starting to struggle. So they are doing a lot for it nowadays, whereas back in the old days, it was just, yeah, I have one of these. Oh, what's that? Oh, that's a man up pill. That attitude has gone. But there you go. That's the way that we've been dealing with it. And I guess they don't do that in America, or haven't done.
As far as I know, we deal more with it after the fact. You know, like after the military, that's where the VA comes into play and all that. But I used to run a PTSD group in a veteran shelter near here. And yeah, people have told me that there's not really any talk about it within the military itself. Yeah,
it has, and it is being destigmatized in the British military. I mean, something that we've been working on for a lot of years. I mean, there is still that stigma attached to a mental health issue, but
yes,
when you analyze it, everybody at some stage will have a problem with their mental health, and it should be something that's dealt with and something that should be talked about and destigmatized, and everybody should feel comfortable talking about how they feel. And they're particularly if they're feeling depressed and something's bothering them, and if you're able to talk to people, sometimes that's all it needs to help is use two of these and one of those in that proportion, and just sit and listen to somebody's problem, and that can be a massive help. And understand that it's not a stigma. It's like suicide. I mean, suicide shouldn't be tabooed. It shouldn't be a stigma, because it is a problem, and it's a mental health problem. Somebody's going through some pain that they're trying to stop, and sometimes all it'll take is somebody to sit down and have a listen to them, so they can get it off their chest. And just by doing that, they generally see that there's something better.
Exactly. I mean, I tell people in every single podcast that I've been on, and I've been on a lot this year alone, but my suicide attempt was like 20 years ago. And now my son is 10 years old. And his sister is 12, who I'm not in a relationship with their mother anymore, but I still consider my daughter. You know, and if I was successful back then, my kid wouldn't be here. It's simple math, you know. And like, I wouldn't be on your podcast. I wouldn't be a seven-time author. I wouldn't, you know, the list goes on and on. There's no telling what you can do after the hardest times of your life.
Yeah.
If you walk through that fire, you will find peace on the other side. You know, you just got to be able to walk through that fire. You know, I've lost many friends to suicide. I've lost. When I was in college, there was a girl, younger, like probably 18 to 20, that sat in the back of the class. One day she wasn't there, and I get teared up when I even think about this. But the professor was like, "Before we start, I got to tell you guys something. You guys know the girl that sat in the back of the class. She unfortunately took her own life this weekend." And I was just like, why? You know, then it's just, I just think about it. Like, I wish I could just go on like a global, you know, horn and just yell out, hold on, you know, just hold on one more day, because your life can be so much better if you just wait. You know, don't let the bad times get to you. Just, I guess all of us. I mean, I just went through one of my best friends in this life just passed away from cancer just last month. And I went through a hard time myself. I had to take a few days off from work because I was overwhelmed with everything, you know. But, you know, take the time off, get the help, talk to someone that will listen. Like you said, I've gone through countless trainings, you know, peer support trainings, and a lot of it is just sitting there and listening to the person. You know, not opening your mouth, just listening to the person. And when they're done, you know, just, if you have something to say to them that is going to encourage them in the right way, then tell them, you know. But there's no magic pill.
No.
You know, just like in addiction recovery, there's no one set way of addiction recovery. You know, there's not. There's just, everyone's got to find their own path. Yeah.
And it just takes somebody to listen. Nine times out of ten. I mean, unfortunately, the determined person that's going to take their own life, you generally won't know about. They'll be successful the first time they try it. The person that isn't overly committed about doing it, that is a cry for help. And that's the people that we can help. But we can also help the determined, you know, to make sure that they know that there's people there that care about them. And that's right. Sometimes it's all it takes. And as long as they know that you're there to listen when they're going for a hard time, and if somebody asks for that sort of help, don't mug them off. Give them that time. Doesn't matter what else is going on in the world. If you just give them that time to open up, to talk, and for you to listen, that's all it takes sometimes to save somebody's life. And I think if we can get that message out, and I'm driving that message forward with my live stream, then we can save, if we can just save one life, it's better than not.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So, Charles, where do you go from here? I mean, you've written half a dozen books.
Yeah. I've, right now I'm in the midst of republishing some of my books. I have ideas for different covers and to add information into the books that I've already published. So I am going to do that. I am going to be coming out with a new book called Blood on Blood, which is, I don't know if you ever listened to Bon Jovi, but it's a song by Bon Jovi, Blood on Blood. It's about him and his childhood friends, and this is about me and my childhood friends, like the one that I was just talking about that passed away. But how they saved my life, because back when after my father died, I really, you know, I pushed every parental figure in my life away. You know, I didn't want anybody else in my life to take his place or take my mother's place. So that was just my frame of thought. You know, like they were gonna try and take their place. So I gravitated towards my friends. They became my family. You know, and they saved my life at that time. You know, I might have went into drinking and stuff that, you know, teenagers and do, but you know, they really helped me out. And one thing that I'm doing now is I'm working for a place called Aware Recovery Care. And what Aware Recovery Care is we meet people where they're at. We meet people in their homes. We meet people, you know, at Dunkin' Donuts, wherever they want to meet and talk with us. We have the client for an entire year, where I've had hundreds of clients in detoxes and CSSs and all that, and I never felt like I had enough time with them. You know, now I feel like I have more than enough time with them to get them going in the right direction for their recovery. You know, so Aware Recovery Care is just an amazing place for people that are listening to it in Massachusetts and Maine, Florida, Connecticut. We're in some of those other states too, Ohio. But yeah, these days I'm just doing the best I can to help out as many people as I can.
Well, you're doing a great job.
Thank you, Tim.
And so are you. And something that needs doing, which is the main thing.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I don't know how the. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, where can people get hold of your books? Where can get people do anything to help?
Lifelongexperience.net is where you can find all my books and everything that I'm about. They're all on there. They're on multiple different platforms, audiobook, all that. So
brilliant. Then put all those links down in the description.
Thank you.
So Charles, it's been an amazing story, and I just thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I feel like I've been waiting a while to be on here with you.
Yeah.
So it's good to finally get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's worth waiting for.
Definitely, without a doubt. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you, definitely.
The Tim Hill Podcasts. Ordinary people's extraordinary stories.
Welcome to the Tim Hill Podcast. If you have the time, you can not only listen to the episodes, but you can also watch all the shows, and you'll find the links in the description below. Thank you.